And it is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman, of course. This hour we visit with Texas defense attorney David Dow. He's represented some 100 death row convicts, has witnessed executions, and is a professor at the University of Houston Law Center. 14 years ago, he founded the Texas Innocence Network. He's the author of The Autobiography of an Execution. His latest work is Things I've Learned from Dying, a Book About Life. And David Dow joins us from Houston Public Media. Good to have you back, David. It's been a couple of years, I think.
It has, Joseph. It is wonderful to be back and to be talking to you again.
Well, here's Bonnie Berman also.
Yes, thanks for joining us. Hi.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. So your memoir is so intensely personal. I'm just wondering why you decided to share on such an intimate level.
The reason I decided to do it is because at the time that my father-in-law, which is one of the stories I tell in the book, was dealing with his melanoma. He was diagnosed with melanoma when he was 58 years old, and it killed him in less than 2 years. He was barely 60 when he died. And at the time that he was struggling with that, I found myself keeping a journal, not a journal in the traditional sense where at the end of every day I would make notes about what had happened that day. As a matter of fact, I think it's Henry James who says somewhere that if you have to take notes on the way that something has affected you, it probably hasn't affected you.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't taking notes about the way I'd been affected. I was taking notes about the particular details of the cancer therapies and treatments that he was considering and often rejecting, and writing down the reasons that he wanted to pursue something or not pursue something else. And when he finally died, I had all of these notes, and I thought I would write a book about what it was like to be mediating between somebody who had cancer, who wanted to surrender to it, and the wishes of that person's family that he continued to struggle. And so I wrote a book, and then I never really did anything with it. I put it on a shelf, and it sat on the shelf for a long time. And then I wrote the last book that Joseph referred to in the introduction, The Autobiography of an Execution, which is not a polemical book about the death penalty. It's really a book about what it's like to be a death penalty lawyer. And the central character in that book, the central client of mine who I write about, is one of the innocent people who I believe has been executed. Joseph also mentioned in the introduction how I believe that I have had clients who were innocent who were nevertheless executed. And so I wrote that book. And then after I finished that book, I was sitting down with my wife one day and talking about the next book that I wanted to write. And I told her that I really thought I wanted to write a book about somebody who was on death row who was not innocent, who had always admitted his guilt, and about whom there was no question that he had participated in a horrible crime. And there were a couple of different guys who I had represented over the years who I thought would make compelling figures in a narrative. But then as I thought about it, I didn't really want to write another death penalty book or another book about somebody on death row. I felt like I had already done that. But in thinking about the different people who I might write about, I realized that one of my clients is somebody who I had been representing and who I had been fighting for during the exact same period of time that my father-in-law, whose name was Peter, had been dealing with his cancer. And as I was thinking about the way those two stories overlapped in my life, I began to appreciate connections between them that I did not appreciate at the time that they were occurring. And then as I was thinking more deeply about those connections, I realized that in the final stages of the legal battle on behalf of my client, my dog, who was a female Doberman that my wife and I had gotten before we were actually married.
I had one of those. They're the best pets.
Oh, they're just the best. They're the best. And I've had dogs my whole adult life, and this dog was just particularly special to me. But during the end stages of my client's struggle, she developed acute liver failure. And so I then began to realize that there were all these other connections about the relationship between me and my dog, the relationship between my son and me, between our son and the dog, that also had some real parallels to both what my father-in-law had gone through and what my client was going through. So I think the reason that I wanted to write the book, in answer to Bonnie's question, is that I became aware of all of these connections that surprised me. And so I wanted to explore the way these three deaths that at some level were very, very different from one another also seemed to me to have common issues and common impacts on the relationships between the people who are facing death and the people they love.
David Dow, you're a professional at breaking bad news to people, lost appeals, execution dates, no stays. So how does that affect how you accept your own bad news with your family, friends, et cetera?
I think that I believed before I witnessed my father-in-law's struggle, I think that I believed that there was nothing about death that would be difficult for me. I've represented well over 100 people. I've had scores of clients be executed. I've witnessed executions. I've told men and women moments before they're going to die that they are, in fact, going to die on schedule. I've been in the rooms when their parents, when their sons, daughters, partners witnessed their executions. I really did feel like there was nothing about death that could surprise me.
I was kind of... I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go ahead, David.
No, and I was just going to say one of the other reasons I wrote the book, and I guess this is circling back to the question that Bonnie asked, is that when I was finally dealing with death under my own roof, I realized that there were, in fact, quite a few things that I didn't know.
I find it curious, David, that you kept this journal of Peter's battle with melanoma. And yet then again, I was looking back in my life. I had a close friend who committed a very gruesome suicide, and something compelled me to get the report from the medical examiner of all the details.
Yes, I think that our motivations might have been very similar. In fact, the reason that my journal started was that my father-in-law was very passive in the face of his diagnosis. The reason I think that he was passive is because he was a very accomplished outdoorsman. He's one of these guys who was hiking across Nepal and Bhutan and Tibet 35, 40 years ago before people were doing that. And in addition to that, he was really a person of the mind. He had a PhD in chemistry. He had been a laboratory scientist for most of his professional career, and then he eventually started supervising other chemists. And he felt like he was going to lose both his body and his mind, and so his reaction was just to surrender to this illness. And in contrast, my wife, his daughter, wanted him to pursue all types of therapies, but because he was so passive, she took on the responsibility of learning everything that there was to learn at that time about established protocols for treating melanomas, experimental protocols for treating melanomas, protocols that were being pursued in other countries but not the U.S. And so simply in order to be able to carry on a conversation with my wife about which of those things made sense and which didn't and which she should urge her father to pursue and which she should just give up on, I started taking notes about the things that she was telling me in the course of exploring and learning about these therapies. And that was really how the journal started. It started out as almost a technical medical manual about the available therapies and the therapies that would be available in the future and that sort of thing. And then it just became a more detailed and richer recollection of the particular conversations that we had in connection, largely in connection with those therapies.
You know, I just find it ironic that your father-in-law, although I understand being an outdoorsman, how he wanted to not, you know, probably die in a hospital bed with tubes, but here you are fighting for the man you write about, Eddie Waterman, as you fight for all your clients. so strenuously, what was it like for you to see that he didn't want to fight when what you do in your life is fight for these people who are going to be killed?
That's an excellent question. There are a couple of things that I want to say about that. The first is that your metaphor is exactly right. In fact, my father-in-law said to me that he had two things that he could do. One is that he could get in his car with his wife and drive out west and go mountain climbing and die on top of a mountain somewhere. And the other thing he said that he could do was to stay here. He and his wife at the time, they didn't live in Houston, but they just lived about an hour and a half north of Houston. And so they were an hour and a half north of the largest cancer hospital in the world, which is in Houston.
MD Anderson.
MD Anderson. And so he said the other thing that he could do was drive down to MD Anderson, and that he, and I'll never forget his language, he said he could die in diapers in an air-conditioned room. And for him, that was an easy choice. But your question is excellent, because my wife said to me, she said to me that my clients live in a 58-square-foot cell, 23 hours a day. They don't have televisions. They don't have computers. They have a radio that gets a couple of stations. They don't have any human contact. When they visit their loved ones, it's through thick plexiglass talking to them on a phone. They don't get to hold them. And my wife said, your clients want to live. And my father, even though he's not going to be able to do some things he loves, will still have the opportunity to be surrounded by people who he loves and by people who love him. And she found it inexplicable that he would not want to fight to the bitter end, given that. And so she asked me whether she thought I would be able to get through to him and communicate to him that he should struggle as hard as my clients struggle. Mm. And when we had that conversation, my father-in-law said to me, he said, I know that you have spent your life trying to extend the lives of other people, but what would you do yourself if you were in my position? And when he asked me that, it put me in the very difficult position of thinking that both he and my wife were right. And the problem with both of their being right is that there wasn't any middle ground. Both of their positions were absolutist, but they didn't overlap in the slightest. And so it raised the question for me of what happens when what is best for the person facing death, which might be a quick, speedy death, is not what is best for the people who love the person who is facing death, which is often not a quick, speedy death. And part of the book, I think, is about how at least I try to negotiate that tension.
We're speaking with David Dow. He's a professor at the University of Houston Law Center and professor of history at Rice University, the founder of the Texas Innocence Network to assist wrongfully convicted inmates establish their innocence. He's also the author of several books. His latest is Things I've Learned from Dying, a book about life. We need to take a break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, 22 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Texas defense attorney David Dow. We're talking about his book, Things I've Learned from Dying. Of course, he's represented some 100 death row convicts. David, in the book, you pose a question. I'm sure all of us think about our impending deaths and how we could handle it, but is it better to have time to tie up loose ends and say goodbyes and be with family, or to go quiet and quick and maybe just not wake up some morning?
I ask the question, and I'm afraid that I don't answer it. So if anybody's thinking about reading the book, because
perhaps people would like to call in. Our number is 1-800-743-9576. Tell us how you feel about that. looming question. 1-800-743-9576. That's WLRN. Also, you can email Bonnie. That's radio@WLRN.org.
David, I was thinking, you said that there were so many connections and they surprised you between these three deaths. But one of the things that I was thinking about, and I want to ask you about the connections, I want to know what they were, but I was thinking about the differences, like the difference in the responsibility factor, the death of your father-in-law and your Doberman, your beloved Doberman, were a result of illness.
Yeah.
And Eddie Waterman's death was the result of his involvement in a murder.
Yes. I think that's a very important observation and a fair point to make. And I don't mean ever to suggest that there was any moral equivalence between or among these three central characters. I've represented death row inmates for more than 20 years, but I'm not a lawyer who believes that there is moral equivalence between my clients and their victims. I don't believe that. I think that my clients did something bad and their victims generally didn't. My client was on death row because he committed a murder. My father-in-law developed malignant melanoma for reasons that I don't know, but I know that they had nothing to do with anything that he did because mm-hmm. he was a kind, good person. So I think that that's a very fair point. And in fact, the observation that you make is very intimately connected to the different degrees of responsibility that I feel and felt for each of the three deaths that I write about. My responsibility in the case of my client was severe. It was serious. At the end of that case, when he was finally executed, I did what I always do, which is I sit down with my team and we go over every decision that we made in the course of representing him. We reverse engineer the entire case, and our objective is to identify places where we made mistakes so we hope we don't learn from them again. And that is a self-flagellating exercise. It has virtues. The idea is that we're going to identify mistakes so we don't make them again. But when you're identifying mistakes that you've made, you can't help but conclude that your mistakes might have, in fact, ultimately been responsible for the death of your client. But wow. Even after conducting that exercise, I get to the end of it, and I tell myself and I tell the people on our team, or my team, that it was our client who made the first mistake. Mm-hmm. He made the mistake that put us in the position of having to reverse engineer this entire case. If he just hadn't killed anybody, we wouldn't have been there. And I don't do that to let us off the hook, because I don't think any of the people who work with me want to be off the hook. But I do that to remind us that we weren't the only people who had some responsibility in the story. In the case of my father-in-law, of course, I didn't have any responsibility at all other than talking to him as he was dealing with this. The decisions that he was making were ultimately his own decisions. On the other hand, in the case of our dog and anybody who's had to ever euthanize a pet, whether it's a dog, a cat, whatever, will know exactly what I'm talking about. I say that our dog, Winona, died from acute liver failure, and in a sense, that's true, but what it really means is that my wife and I decided to euthanize her because she was suffering from acute liver failure. And so there was a direct connection between her death and our actions in a way that was not present in either of the two stories. All of which is to say, Bonnie, that you're absolutely right. There are some similarities in these stories, but there are also some real significant differences. And at some level, I think those significant differences explain why some of these were more emotionally difficult for me to work my way through than others.
David Dow, because we have this commonality of the female Dobies, mine was named Liba. And I had to put her down at 8 or 8:30 in the morning, and then I had to come to work because I had the mayor on or something I was going to interview, and it was so difficult, that ride down the highway to get to work and also the breaks during the programs. It was, and, you know, it was like, you know, a family member had died, of course.
Oh, it's brutal. I can relate not only to the experience, but even to the time of day when Winona was sick. We had gone to visit her at the emergency clinic every day that she was there, and she was getting progressively worse. And the day before my wife and I finally made the decision, we had been there at the clinic the night before until basically they kicked us out, and we came home. Our son was 8 years old at the time, and so when he was getting ready to go to school the next morning, he said to my wife and me while he was eating breakfast that he was going to make Winona a get well card at school that day, and could we take it to her as soon as he got home. And we told him that we would. And so he went to school, and not 5 minutes after the carpool picked him up, the vet called and said that Winona had gotten much worse overnight, and he really thought that we needed to make a decision. So Katya and I drove over to the hospital where Winona was. She was completely non-responsive, and we made the decision that morning at 8 or 8:30 that morning to have her euthanized. And then for me, what was the hardest part about writing the book, the hardest part about editing the book, the hardest part about rereading pages. When I do readings, I can't even contemplate reading this part of the book because I wouldn't be able to get through it. The hardest part of writing the book was telling the story about what happened when our son got home and walked in the door and sloughed the backpack off of his back and was reaching in to pull out the card that he was going to get so that we could go get in the car and take it to Winona. And we told him standing in the doorway that Winona had died that morning. And he dissolved in a way that I did not imagine he was going to dissolve. And it was the only time in his life up until that point, and for that matter ever since, that he has been literally inconsolable. And I simply didn't anticipate the depth of the injury and how long the injury was going to last that he suffered as a result, not just of the decision to euthanize Winona. He would have understood if he had been with us that morning that it was the time to euthanize her, but the injury that was caused by his feeling like he hadn't got to tell this dog goodbye. He had known this dog since the day he came home from the hospital. Winona was 5 years old on the day that we brought him home from the hospital. And so he had known this dog every single day of his 8-year-old life. And he was simply devastated by it.
But you know, you did the right thing because the vet called you and she was ready to go. So the question is, you know, you didn't know how much suffering you were going to cause Lincoln, your son,
yeah.
But you would have caused more suffering to Winona had you let her live the entire day till he got home.
So, I hope you're right. Yeah, I hope you're right, Bonnie. I of course, don't know. And I will say that one of the things that I wanted to write about in the book is that As I mentioned when we were talking a few minutes ago, I've had dogs my whole adult life, so Winona is not the first dog that I've had to euthanize. But the dog that I had to euthanize immediately before Winona was also a female Doberman named Whitney. She had spinal cancer. And there was one day where I woke up in the morning and Whitney could not move. The spinal cancer had progressed to the point that she couldn't get up off the floor. She couldn't stand up. She couldn't go out. She didn't want to eat, and it was clear to me that was the day. And I made the mistake in retrospect. Of course, I didn't know it was a mistake at the time, but in retrospect, it was clearly a mistake. I made the mistake of inferring that it would always be clear when the moment to act was. Mm. So because it was clear in Whitney's case, I thought it would always be clear. And I'm not sure that it was the right moment in Winona's case. It might have been a day too late. It might have been a week too late. It might have been a day or a week too early. I don't know. And so I think that, I mean, clearly, we saved her from suffering. Whether the dog, you know, would have preferred to suffer a little bit more so that she could have died at home surrounded by me and my wife and our son is obviously a question that you just don't ever have the luxury of knowing the answer to.
No, none of us do.
Yeah.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with David Dow. He's a Texas attorney who's represented some 100 death row convicts, witnessed executions. He also says that he knows that some of these executions were of innocent men. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Let's take a call. This is a JL listener in Delray. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to respond to a comment. Your book, by the way, sounds very interesting. I look forward to reading it. But the question you raised, and I think people that think they have the chance, they would prefer to have the chance to have a long, drawn-out goodbye to their loved ones versus somebody dying quickly. I can honestly say from somebody that's lost her spouse not that long ago that there is no answer to that question, because we'd all like to be able to say goodbye, but some of the memories I have, I wish I could unremember. That's how horrible they can be. So I think maybe the real issue at stake is to make every day count with the people that we have and not, you know, not have regrets while we're living.
I think that's an excellent observation, and I like the word regret too, because one of the things I talk about in the book is how regret is this almost unbelievably powerful feeling or emotion that we have. And the thing about regret is that, unlike love, love is very powerful too, but we don't choose to love. We can't make decisions that either cause us to love or cause us not to love. Love is just something that happens between two people. But regret is something, in fact, that we can typically avoid by acting in a certain way. And so one of the things that I learned from dying is, in fact, precisely what the caller said, which is that regret is this powerful thing, but it is a powerful thing that by acting in a certain way, we can either avoid entirely or at least minimize.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
David, getting back to Eddie Waterman, because you have worked on the behalf of so many clients, what differentiated his case from the others? Why do you say you never wanted to save anybody more than he?
There have been other people who I've represented who were as transformed by the time that they were executed from the person who they had been when they committed the crime as Eddie Waterman was. He's not the only person by any means who I've represented who I felt was a completely different person at the time that he was put to death than he was when he entered prison. But I wanted to write about him because I felt like his transformation was a transformation that even death penalty supporters would acknowledge. I live in Texas, where 7 out of 10 people support the death penalty. We live in the United States, where 6.2 out of 10 people nationwide support the death penalty. And so if you're going to write a book and one of the three people who you're writing about is somebody on death row, there's a chance that between 60 and 70% of the available readers aren't really going to care very much about one of those deaths. And I thought that I could write about Eddie Waterman in a way that people who have that inclination would at least pause when they knew his story. This is a guy who went into prison, arrived on death row when he was 19 years old. He had a sixth grade education. He'd been living essentially on his own since he was 9 years old because his father had abandoned the family and his mother was a paranoid schizophrenic who was taken away to a mental institution after trying to kill my client one afternoon with a butcher knife by chasing him around the house and stabbing him to death. And in the 12, 13 years that he was on death row, he turned into a person who not only didn't resemble the person who he had been when he arrived there, not only that, but was fully aware of all of the ways in which he didn't resemble that person anymore. He didn't like that person anymore. He once said to me, the person who I was on the day that I got here is somebody who they should have executed. Mm. One of the things that I think many people would be surprised to learn is that most death row inmates, like most of the U.S. population, are not against the death penalty. They don't think that they should be executed, obviously, but they think that other people should be executed. And my client is somebody who thought that the person he used to be was one of those people who should have been executed. And so he was simply a very compelling human being to me. And I thought that I'd be able to write about him in a way that would not, I'm not interested in this book, in changing the minds of death penalty supporters. I used to be a death penalty supporter, and I can talk to death penalty supporters in a way that is calculated to attempt to change their mind. That's not my objective in this book. My objective in this book is to show that there are people on death row who even death penalty supporters will acknowledge are not the people that we should be executing, even if we're going to be executing anybody at all.
When we spoke about your last book, The Autobiography of an Execution, David Dow, a couple of years ago, I remember asking you the question, is why is Texas the New York Yankees of executions? And you would think that anybody would bend over backwards to make sure that they weren't executing an innocent person, but it's quite the opposite in Texas.
It is the opposite. If you bend over backwards to make sure that you're not going to execute an innocent person, then you're not going to execute anybody, because death penalty cases are not typically cases that have DNA evidence. DNA is the gold standard of evidence. When we have DNA that either implicates somebody or that exculpates somebody, we can be sure, to the extent that human beings can be sure about anything, that we either have the right person or the wrong person. But most death penalty cases, including most death penalty cases in Texas, are not DNA cases. And so we never, ever have that degree of certainty. We don't even have that degree of certainty when people admit to crimes, because one of the extraordinary things that we have learned from this spate of DNA exonerations over the last 20 years, there have been more than 315 people in the U.S. exonerated on the basis of DNA. And what it means to say that is that there have been more than 315 people who we are absolutely positive were in prison for something they didn't do. And in 25% of those cases, one out of four of those cases, the person who was on death row, or not necessarily death row, but in prison, the person who was in prison had absolutely nothing to do with this crime, and yet the person confessed to committing the crime. So even when we have somebody who is admitting to having done something, we still can't be sure that the person actually did it. So if Texas were going to lean over backward to make 100% sure that every single person facing lethal injection was somebody who committed the crime, Texas would never execute anybody, because the exercise of acquiring that certainty is something that takes so long and so much energy and so many resources that you wouldn't have any time or money left to carry out the executions. And so of necessity, Texas frequently executes people when there are still very serious questions about whether the person actually committed the crime.
You said that you actually favored the death penalty at one point, and yet you turned your passions to representing those on death row. Why? And why did you change your views on the death penalty?
The question of why is that I became a death penalty lawyer by accident. I went to death row one day, not because I was interested in the death penalty and not because I was interested in prison conditions, but because I was teaching a course that had a very slight component of it that touched on death penalty law. So as a means of educating myself, I thought that I should meet some people on death row and see what the conditions were. And it so happens that at that time, death row inmates were not entitled to a lawyer during their habeas corpus appeals, which are very important appeals in death penalty cases. And one of the guys who I met when I went to the prison is somebody who was scheduled to be executed about 2 weeks from the day that I met him. And he didn't have a lawyer and he'd never had his appeals. And so this is a guy who was faced with representing himself in a very complex legal proceeding. And so I agreed to represent him, even though I had never done a death penalty case, even though I knew nothing about handling a death penalty case. I agreed to represent him because I thought we shouldn't be executing people who didn't have lawyers. And that case led to a second, and a second led to a third, and then all of a sudden you wake up and 20 years have gone by and you've become a death penalty lawyer. Mm. So I came to it by accident. At the time that I came to it, I wasn't against the death penalty. I wasn't somebody who was a rabid supporter of the death penalty. It frankly was not an issue that I had spent very much time thinking about. If you had asked me at the time whether I was in favor or opposed to the death penalty, I would have said, I'm in favor of it. But it was not such an important issue to me, for example, that I would have ever decided who to vote for on the basis of a candidate's stand on the death penalty. But sure, I thought that there were people who the state should execute. I didn't think they should be my clients, but I did not have a categorical opposition to the death penalty. And then two things happened. The first thing that happened is what I refer to as my lawyer's moment. My lawyer's moment was a result of this preconception that I had. The preconception was that everybody I was going to meet on death row was going to be somebody like Charles Manson or Hannibal Lecter. And of course, Charles Manson is in prison in California, but he's not even on death row. And Hannibal Lecter from Silence of the Lambs is a fictional character. Mm-hmm. And what I realize is the people on death row aren't anything like Charles Manson or Hannibal Lecter typically. They're very different. They're there in part because of what they did, unquestionably. Almost all of them killed somebody, and that explains part of why they are there, but it doesn't explain all of it. The people on death row are disproportionately people of color. They are disproportionately people whose victims were white rather than people of color. They are not only disproportionately, but almost unanimously people who do not have significant economic resources. And I'm an American and I'm a lawyer and I believe in the value of equality. And I think that it's one thing to say that if you're rich, you get to eat at a fancy restaurant, and if you're poor, you have to eat at McDonald's. But I think it's a very different thing to say that if you're rich, you get one criminal justice system, but if you're poor, you get another one. That seems to me to be a violation of this basic equality value in a way that which restaurant you get to eat at isn't. And so that was the first thing that happened to me. The second thing that happened to me is that I got to know my clients. You get to know your clients as human beings. You get to know their moms, their dads, their brothers, their sisters, their sons, their daughters, their partners, sometimes their grandparents. And you begin to see your clients as human beings who have done a horrible thing rather than as just a horrible thing. If you ever read a newspaper article, whether it's in the Miami Herald or the Houston Chronicle or for that matter the New York Times, about somebody who is going to be executed, the article is almost always exclusively about what that person did. And so all that you know, if you just know about the people who were on death row from what you read in the newspaper, is this one truly horrific crime that they committed. And so it's easy to collapse who the human being is into that one horrific, terrible thing that the person did. But once you begin to represent the people who are in prison, you don't collapse those two things into one another any longer. You can't. It's impossible because you can't unlearn what you know, and you come to know these people and their families. And so the second thing that happened to me is, I think, what would happen to most human beings, including most human beings who support the death penalty, because that's the kind of human being I was. And you begin to see your clients as people who did a bad thing rather than as the bad thing itself.
Mm. We're speaking with David Dow. He is a professor at the University of Houston Law Center. He's represented some 100 death row convicts. And he's the founder of the Texas Innocence Network. By the way, their website is texasinnocencenetwork.com. His latest book is Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life. One more short break, and we'll be right back.
And a rather sobering topical currents on this Wednesday afternoon. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, attorney David Dow. We're talking about his book, Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life. Of course, he's represented some 100 death row convicts and witnessed some of their executions. David, does the constant living in the presence of impending death have a psychological effect on you, or what is that psychological effect?
The psychological effect is such that hardly a day goes by that I don't tell myself I really need to start doing something else.
Really?
It is a psychological effect that I think death penalty lawyers in Texas face uniquely. I actually work with lawyers in Florida on behalf of 3 or 4 inmates on death row in Florida.
What is Florida, second or third in the number of executions?
Florida's way down the list in the number of executions.
Really?
It's third in the number of people on death row.
I see. Mm.
But Florida has really slowed down the number of executions that it's carried out. I suppose that actually, if you go all the way back to the resumption of the death penalty, Florida still might be third.
We had one about 10 days ago.
Yeah, but over the last 3 or 5 years, Florida has slowed down. Yeah, you had one about 10 days ago, and you probably won't have another one if you have another one in Florida until October. And that's a typical pace in a death penalty state. If you have more than a couple of executions a year, it's been a busy year. In Texas, we typically have an execution every 3 weeks or so.
Wow.
And so you have a client get executed, and you don't get to get into your truck and go on a cross-country drive for a couple of weeks until your mind clears, because you have to be at the office the next day working on behalf of your next client who is scheduled to get executed 2 or 3 or 4 weeks down the road. So I think that the psychological toll that the work takes, in answer to your question, Joseph, is simply that it is unrelenting, that it just never eases up. And so it constantly forces one to ask oneself whether there's any value that's being served here. Most of my clients have been executed. Most of my clients who are still alive who haven't been executed are in fact going to be executed. And so one might say, why do you keep doing it? What is the offsetting benefit of continuing to do it?
And how do you answer that?
I don't know if this is an answer that will satisfy you, Bonnie, or satisfy the listeners, but I'll tell you what my answer is. And I want to tell you my answer by telling you what my clients tell me when I tell them that they're about to die. In most of our cases, we still have appeals pending up until the day of the execution. The reason for that, to be honest, is that the Supreme Court doesn't like to tell you its answer until everybody else has told you their answer. So they wait until the last possible minute to tell you whether they're going to rule for you or against you. And the consequence of that is that the clerk of the Supreme Court might be calling me at 5:30 or 5:40 in the afternoon when the execution is scheduled for 6. And then I call my client or see my client, depending on where I am, with the news. And the most common thing that my clients say to me when I tell them that they're going to be dead in 39 minutes, the most common thing that they say to me is, thank you. And then they tell me to thank all of the other members of the team, the other lawyers who worked with me, the students who worked on the case, the interns in our office who worked on the case. And the first time that this happened to me, 20 years ago, the first time that I called somebody to tell him he was about to be dead and he said, thank you, I was flabbergasted. And then it happened over and over and over. All these guys, I'm telling them they're about to be dead, and they're saying thank you. And the reason is that these are typically people who have never had anyone single-mindedly devoted to saving their lives. They come from dizzyingly dysfunctional homes. The word dysfunctional doesn't even begin to approach it. They had parents who were indifferent to them at best. They didn't have teachers who cared. They didn't encounter judges in the juvenile justice system who cared. Their lawyers didn't care. Nobody ever cared about them. And my team and I try to save them. And what they are thanking us for is leaving no gasoline in the tank in our effort to save their lives. That's why they're thanking us. In a way, the fact that we have failed isn't even the most important fact to them. The most important fact to them is that they perceive correctly that we tried as hard as any human being can try. And that's the reason I keep doing it, because I think that the work is meaningful to the inmates, even when the work doesn't bear the typical fruit of success that I wish it would bear more often.
Well, I wish we had another hour to talk to you. David Dow is an attorney. He's a professor at the University of Houston Law Center, professor of history at Rice University, and the founder of the Texas Innocence Network. His latest book is Things I've Learned from Dying, a book about life, and we'll have links to that on our website and our Facebook page. Thank you, David, so much, and
good
best
to hear from
you.
Good to hear from you, David.
You're very welcome, Bonnie and Joseph. I've very much enjoyed talking to you both.
And that wraps up today's program. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and program downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, discussion, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with a focus on domestic violence. In Florida and other states, people convicted of domestic abuse can keep guns in their home. In fact, they could even purchase them. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's annual Super Bowl bash extravaganza. And now the calendar. On this day in 1845, 169 years ago, Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven is published, making him a celebrity. It's written in trochaic octameter. Quote the raven, nevermore. And on this day in 1880, 134 years ago, the birth of misanthrope W.C. Fields in Philadelphia. Of course, he died on the day he most despised, Christmas. He was also despised by his frequent co-star, Mae West. And one more while we ponder the world's most influential woman. On this day in 1954, 60 years ago, the birth of Oprah Winfrey in Kosciuszko, Mississippi, a rural child who wore potato sacks. She was the world's first black billionaire. She was also has a home on Fisher Island in Miami. This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.